Good day. Today is Tuesday, 18th November 2025. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you once again, if you watch this programme and you like what you've heard or like whatever part of the programme you want to listen to, then please do tick the like button to signify that fact. Anyway, let me now proceed with the rest of the programme. And can I just say that over the last 24 hours, the news that's been coming out either about Ukraine, from Ukraine itself, or connected to Ukraine, is becoming stranger and stranger. Indeed, it is becoming, frankly, bizarre. Let's begin, first of all, with some reports that have been coming out of Moscow. Now, a few days ago, the FSB, the Russian Counterintelligence Agency, which is also responsible for anti-terrorism and other steps within the law enforcement system, said that it had discovered and prevented a plot by the Ukrainian special services to assassinate an important Russian personality. And the suggestions were that this was somebody connected with the Russian military, a senior Russian military official. The FSB gave no further information. And in fact, I have heard very little more about this plot. I don't know who or whether anyone or who that would be who has been arrested. I don't know what the state of the investigations is. I don't know whether there's any plans to bring anybody to trial. It is all very mysterious. Well, yesterday, a Russian newspaper, Moskovsky Komsomolets, which could be described as a sort of tabloid, though I ought to say that tabloids in Russia, or newspapers that might be called tabloids in Russia, newspapers that aim for a wider public audience than more specialised and heavyweight newspapers like, say, Kommersant and Vyedomosti and newspapers of that kind. Anyway, Moskovsky Komsomolets is now claiming that the personality, the target that the Ukrainians intended to kill was none other than Sergei Shoigu, who is a general in the Russian armed forces, has been the former defense minister of Russia, and before that, the minister of the emergency, dealing with emergencies, and who is currently the secretary of Russia's Security Council, of which, of course, he is a member, and a position which makes him, in effect, Putin's national security advisor, though he clearly shares that position with Yuri Ushakov, who mostly advises Putin, so far as I can tell, on relations with the Western countries and with the United States. Shoigu is also the person who, as I understand it, has a general role in coordinating the information from the intelligence agencies, the various intelligence services, which Putin is provided. And he also conducts important diplomatic missions for the Russian government. So he has been active in visiting North Korea and Iran, and also China over the last few months. So a very important and very well-known person indeed. Somebody who is absolutely a key figure within the Russian leadership. Now, I remember that a couple of weeks ago, Zelensky had a meeting with the head of the SBU, one of the vast number of intelligence services that exists in Ukraine, but perhaps one of the most important ones. Anyway, he had a meeting with Malyuk in which he basically appeared to give Maliouk instructions to move forward, to act upon certain special work that would be conducted inside Russia itself. And about a week ago, he also had a meeting with Kirill Budanov, who is the head of Ukrainian military intelligence. And he also appeared to assign to Budanov certain assigned tasks, some certain important tasks. I must say that when I heard about the meeting with Budanov, I assumed it was connected with the various operations that the military intelligence, Ukrainian military intelligence, has been conducting around Pokrovsk, the abortive landing of the helicopters, the attempt to extract, this is what I believe it was, to extract some important person or persons from inside Pokrovsk, something of that kind. Anyway, I assumed that Zelensky's instructions to Budanov related to that. But, well, we now have this information from Moscow. Now, there is no doubt at all that Ukraine has had a history of conducting assassinations against people in Russia, and even more against people in Donbass. This was widely denied for a very long time, even as prominent militia leaders and political figures in the breakaway republics of the Donbass, the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, were being assassinated. If you followed the Western media, for a long time they were suggesting that these killings were the result of internecine struggles amongst these militia leaders. For the record, I always believed that they were the work of the Ukrainian authorities, and that is no longer disputed anymore. Budanov himself, some months ago, about a year ago, admitted that the Ukrainians had made at least one attempt to assassinate no less a person than President Putin himself. In fact, the way I read Budanov's words, I got the impression that he meant that there had been more than one assassination attempt. I think I can identify one of these attempts. Some years ago, about 2 years ago, I think, a Ukrainian drone made an attempt to attack the Senate building in the Kremlin, which is, of course, the building within which Putin has his office. And I thought at the time, and believe still, that this was an assassination attempt, and the obvious target was Putin himself. So, yes, the Ukrainians do have a record for this kind of thing. They have effectively admitted this. As I said, Budanov has admitted at least one attempted assassination attempt against Putin. And the media in the United States and the West now openly acknowledges that the Ukrainians have indeed conducted assassinations of Donbass militia leaders and political figures, and indeed assassinations within Russia itself. But anyway, this latest attack, if it really was planned by the Ukrainians, would mark a very significant escalation at this particular time. Now, is it true? The FSB have not provided us with much information about the plot they say they have uncovered. And, well, Moskovsky Komsomolets, I am not sure how reliable as a newspaper it actually is. Possibly, it's not inconceivable that it is being provided this information by the FSB itself. Anyway, I am going to reserve final judgment, but I will make two quick observations. Firstly, if the Ukrainians really have attempted to assassinate Sergei Shoigu, then that would be completely unsurprising. That is one. Secondly, if the Ukrainians were attempting to assassinate Sergei Shoigu, particularly at this time, this would be an extraordinary public escalation. It would be a further sign of how desperate Ukraine is becoming about the deteriorating situation on the battlefronts, in the economy, within Ukrainian society. It would obviously, as the Ukrainians would know, it would obviously trigger a strong reaction from Moscow. It's the kind of act which the Russians could not fail to respond to. It would be impossible not to respond to it. And, well, I've already discussed how there is now clear evidence that the Russians are themselves taking a more active role in what might be called the dirty war. I've expressed my own belief that the murder of Andrei Paruby, the Ukrainian political leader, the Maidan commandant and all of that, might have had a Russian hand. This has been disputed by some, though the Ukrainian authorities continue to insist on it. But I think that if somebody like Shoigu were publicly assassinated, then we would not be looking at a battle conducted in the shadows. The Russian response would be an active one, and I don't myself think there is any doubt that it would target key people in Kiev, and the Ukrainians must know this. They would be looking for some kind of major escalation themselves. Now, all of this is extraordinary. It's already extraordinary, and as I said, it shows how critical the situation is starting to look. But we've had further extraordinary news over the last couple of hours. Now, yesterday, reports started to trickle out of Poland that there had been sabotage done on the railways, on the railway tracks, somewhere in Poland. I'm not quite clear why. Anyway, inevitably, the fingers began to point at the Russians. The Polish authorities made it fairly clear that they suspected that it was the Russians who were involved. However, just minutes before I started making this program, Poland's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, a staunch ally of Ukraine and somebody who, against mounting scepticism from within Poland, continues to insist on Poland's commitment to support of Ukraine. Anyway, he has just announced that the saboteurs, the people who did the damage to the railway tracks in Poland, were Ukrainians. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know whether, if he means Ukrainians, they were people perhaps from Donbass who were angry with Poland for supporting the government in Kiev. However, I have to say, if that was what Tusk meant, I would have thought that he would not have called them Ukrainians. He might have called them secessionists or some such word, or separatists. Instead, he called them Ukrainians. And again, I have to say, I do wonder whether this is another case of some kind of false flag operation, or at least attempted false flag operation, which went wrong. I am not going to say more, because as at the time of making this programme, I have minimal information about this event. And, well, I'm going to wait and see and discuss it further in my next programme. All I would say is that if Ukrainians were involved in this sabotage attack, then if those Ukrainians were acting at the behest of the Ukrainian authorities, I cannot but imagine that it will cause further damage between Poland and Ukraine at a time when Polish opinion is becoming increasingly exasperated with the Tusk government's support for Ukraine. So that's another step. And of course, if the Ukrainians are behaving in this way, once again, it points clearly to an extraordinary degree, a reckless degree of escalation and increasing, irresponsibility is the word I'm going to use, that you could use a much stronger one, on behalf of the leadership in Kiev, an increasing sense that they feel that the situation is spiralling out of their control and that they need to escalate the situation in some way, presumably to try to get the Western powers more deeply involved in the conflict in Ukraine. Well, these are two very strange incidents, and I touched on them because they're clearly important. But to repeat again, I don't have full information about either. The next incident is even more bizarre. Now, over the last couple of days, we've been hearing reports coming out of Kiev that contradicting what the Ukrainian deputy foreign minister said in an interview which he gave to the Times of London, that all talks between Ukraine and Russia had been suspended until the end of the year. Anyway, we got reports that the Ukrainians, that Zelensky, that the Ukrainian authorities were reaching out to the Russians in order to try to negotiate a new prisoner of war exchange and perhaps to get the talks between Ukraine and Russia going again. And all of these reports appeared in conjunction with the hurried trip to Turkey, to Istanbul, of the former Ukrainian defense minister Rustem Umerov. He's currently the secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. Anyway, he was supposed to be going to Turkey in order to get these talks restarted. That was what was being said in Kiev. That was what Umerov himself was saying. Of course, there was a further intrigue about his visit. There was a widespread view expressed in Ukraine and elsewhere that the true reason Umerov made the dash to Turkey was because of the corruption scandal in Kiev, that there was a possibility that the corruption investigators from Nabu and Sapo might want to speak with him, that he didn't want to answer their questions. He might even have been worried about a possible arrest, and Zelensky might have been worried about that possible arrest also. So pack him off to Kiev, to Turkey, send him there, trying to get some kind of talks set up with the Russians. That would be a convenient way to get him out of Kiev. And then, as I discussed in my programme yesterday, reports started to circulate that Umerov, after having some discussions with the Turkish authorities, eliciting some comments from Turkish Foreign Minister Fidan, who again spoke about negotiations being about to be restarted between Ukraine and Russia and about the good prospects of these negotiations. Anyway, after Umerov, who, by the way, I should say, is a Crimean Tatar and who speaks, of course, the Tatar language, which is close to Turkish, close enough to Turkish so that he can speak to the Turkish officials and without needing translators, apparently. Anyway, there were then reports that Umerov, instead of staying in Istanbul, or indeed in Turkey, had made a dash to the Arab Gulf states, that he'd visited Qatar and the UAE. And in my program yesterday, I speculated that this might indeed be connected in some way with the corruption scandal in Kiev. It might be connected to the fact that the UAE in particular is an important financial centre. Dubai in particular, as everyone knows, is a very important banking and financial centre. And I wondered whether Umerov's trip to the UAE might be in some way connected with that. Anyway, yesterday, after I finished making my program, reports started to circulate in Kiev that Umerov has contacted Zelensky and has told Zelensky that he does not intend to return to Kiev. I'm not quite sure what that means, whether it means that he never intends to return to Kiev. These are only rumours, but there doesn't appear to be so far any very convincing denial, just to say. I mean, there have been some comments that seem to, from the government, which seem to contradict that, but no very convincing denial at the moment. And certainly, Umerov doesn't seem to be, for the moment, very interested in going back. Now, there's been a further twist to all of this morning, because Putin's spokesman in Moscow, Dmitry Peskov, has now spoken about all of this. And he said that the Russians have received no contacts from Ukraine seeking or requesting a resumption of the negotiations in Istanbul. The Russians know about Umerov's trip to Turkey. They've seen the reports. They know about Umerov's contacts with Fidan and with other Turkish officials. The Russians have also heard rumours that Steve Witkoff, President Trump's envoy, might be coming to Turkey as well. But up to now, no one has contacted them to tell them anything about any of this. They know nothing about it. They know nothing about Umerov, prisoner of war exchanges, resumptions of diplomatic contacts, or anything like that. Nor have the Ukrainians made clear to the Russians what a resumption of diplomatic contacts at this time of negotiations of talks in Istanbul would actually involve. Though Peskov, as far as I know, didn't mention the fact, the last time the Ukrainians and the Russians met in Istanbul, the Russians produced a set of proposals, one of which was for the upgrading of the two delegations, for more senior people to be appointed to head them, and for the setting up of three working parties to discuss the various areas of dispute in the conflict. The Russians say that they have been waiting for Ukraine's response to that proposal, but it has never come. That interview, which the Ukrainian deputy foreign minister gave a week ago to the London Times, spoke dismissively of this Russian suggestion, said that the Russians weren't interested in discussing the substantive topic, which for the Ukrainians was an immediate ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, something which in reality, of course, the Russians have always rejected. They were coming up with these trivial ideas about working parties instead. Anyway, that comment by Ukraine's deputy foreign minister suggests that the Ukrainians have still not given any thought, or had still not given any thought as of the time of that interview, to the Russian proposal for the setting up of the three working parties. And nothing I have heard about Umerov's trip to Istanbul suggests that even now the Ukrainians have anything like that in mind. So the Russians are basically saying that they're actually baffled by all of this. They don't know what it is exactly that the Ukrainians and perhaps the Americans have in mind. If the Turks and the Americans want to explain it, or if the Ukrainians do, they're welcome. Russia is always willing to discuss prisoner of war exchanges and, of course, the resumption of the talks. But so far, they've heard nothing substantive, nothing concrete, and they are completely unclear about what Zelensky's current negotiating strategy or proposals is or are. So anyway, that's from the Russians. It all looks, it's increasingly looking to me as if Umerov's disappearance, which is not perhaps quite a defection, but perhaps it's starting to look a little bit like a desertion from his post, which is an important one, as Secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. Anyway, as if Umerov has basically fled Ukraine, and that all pretense that he is trying to restart negotiations, that pretense is being abandoned, and that the cover story has gone. Now, almost certainly, this is connected to the corruption scandal. But again, it cannot but help reinforce the sense that things in Kiev are beginning to fall apart. Now, there is one last dimension to this story. Yesterday, I spoke about President Zelensky going off and visiting various European capitals on a road trip. I said that he'd concluded fictitious agreements in Greece and France, and we've had now the details, more of the details about those agreements, which again, to reiterate, I consider to be completely fictitious. Firstly, there is the suggestion that Greece can act as a transit corridor for liquefied natural gas to reach Ukraine from the United States. Certainly, an agreement to that effect was signed, and well, it's discussed, and I believe it was signed. Certainly, Ukraine is desperately short of gas in light of the Russian attacks. There was an article about it in the Financial Times, which gave it the impression that it was all very impressive and very substantive. But realistically, none of this is going to make any difference to Ukraine's energy and economic situation at this point in the war. Certainly, it cannot resolve Ukraine's energy crisis over the course of this winter. But the trip to France has acquired a surreal quality all of its own. Because over the course of it, Zelensky signed off on an agreement with Macron for Ukraine, a bankrupt country, currently spending twice as much as what it manages to collect in taxes a country with a debt to GDP ratio of over 100%, a country which is struggling to raise funds in the West, and a country which is struggling to get its creditors to roll over debt. Anyway, Zelensky has just signed off on a deal to buy 100 super expensive Rafale jet fighters from France. This, a few weeks after Zelensky signed off on a similar deal in Sweden to buy 150 Gripen fighter jets in Sweden. I don't think there is anybody who takes either the Swedish contract or the French contract that Zelensky has just signed seriously. These are preposterous numbers. Just to say, if we're talking about the 150 Gripens, the Russian Air Force, which is a big air force by international standards, I believe it's either the third or the fourth biggest air force in the world, after those of the United States and China. And perhaps it's also smaller than India's as well, though I'm not sure. But anyway, the Russian Air Force operates, I believe, 150 of the super powerful Sukhoi 34 fighter bombers. 150 Gripens plus 100 Rafale fighter jets would give Ukraine a modern air force 2.5 times bigger than the current Royal Air Force, the current number of fighter jets, around 100, that the Royal Air Force, the British Air Force, has operational. I mean, these are fantastic, ridiculous figures. And as a number of people are pointing out, the order book for both the Gripen and even more the Rafale is full. It would take years before any of these fighter jets appeared. The French plan is for these fighter jets to be delivered within a time frame of 10 years. It is completely surreal. It's not going to intimidate the Russians, who are not going to take any of it seriously. It again shows how completely out of touch with reality Zelensky and his officials are. Now, that is not to say that there isn't some purpose to these contracts. What it means is that Zelensky can go to Sweden and now to France and can give reasons for people back in Kiev, in Ukraine, as to why he is visiting these countries. He can say that he's going there because after the war, he's going to build up Ukraine's air force to this mighty level. I doubt that many people in Ukraine are convinced, but at least it gives Zelensky a convenient excuse, as I said, to visit Stockholm and Paris at this time. It also provides Ukraine with a further public commitment of support from the governments of Sweden and France, even if both of these governments must deep down know how fantastic this contract is. And lastly, it is extremely provocative towards the Russians. The Russians have made it a central point in the negotiations to settle the conflict in the conflict that Ukraine reduce very significantly the scale of its armed forces. And here we have Zelensky signing deals that obviously completely cut across that. But even if you can provide that kind of rationale, the sheer scale of these deals makes them so absurd that they undermine every one of the pretexts that I've just outlined. If Zelensky had gone to Sweden and signed a deal for 24 Gripens and had gone to France and signed a deal for, say, 24 Rafales, well, it would probably still have been unrealistic. In fact, it would have definitely been unrealistic. But it would at least have had about it some element of plausibility. 48 fighter jets, very advanced fighter jets, is a credible number for a country the size of Ukraine. 250 fighter jets is so grandiose, so grotesquely fantastic that nobody can take it seriously or quite believe it. To reiterate again, all that it does is demonstrate further how completely out of touch with reality Zelensky and his officials have become. Though sadly, it also shows the extraordinary extent to which Western governments, in this case the Swedish and the French governments, are prepared to continue to indulge these fantasies. Anyway, after leaving France, what does Zelensky do? Does he go to Britain, which is at least a nuclear power and a strong ally and friend, and where the tottering government of Keir Starmer is also fervidly loyal to Ukraine? Does he go to Germany to meet Friedrich Merz? Does he go to Brussels to meet Ursula von der Leyen? No, Zelensky goes to Spain. Why exactly at this time is he going to Spain? Is there anything that Spain can contribute to the war, to Ukraine's struggle against Russia? I would say not. Spain does have an arm, a military, but Prime Minister Sanchez has defied Donald Trump's pressure to increase defense spending. Spain does have a military industrial complex, and it does indeed produce some important weapon systems, but nothing like on the scale of what France does, or indeed on what Sweden does. Certainly, Spain cannot provide Ukraine with fighter jets or air defense missiles or tanks, because as far as I know, Spain doesn't make them, at least not the kind of weapon systems that Ukraine needs at this time. If it does produce them, it will be in minimal quantities. And given that Spain's defense spending is low, it's doubtful that the Spanish are in much of a position to provide Ukraine with weapons from their own arsenal. And of course, there's the further factor that in Spain itself, there is a certain segment of the population which is more critical of support for Ukraine. So, what exactly is Zelensky doing there? Well, there can be all kinds of views. Maybe, again, he's got other people he wants to meet in Spain. Spain is a place where all sorts of interesting people from Ukraine, and indeed Russia also, by the way, go to retire. Very interesting people in some cases. There was an assassination a few months ago of one particular person who was living in Spain, as I remember, and had gone to live there from Ukraine. So that might be a reason for going. It might be a reason if Zelensky himself might perhaps one day be thinking of retiring there as well. Spain, by the way, also has an interesting financial system, about which I'm not going to say any more, but it could conceivably be that Zelensky is interested in finding out about that. Though how all that would fit in with an official trip to meet Prime Minister Sanchez, I still can't figure out. Anyway, the impression, again, is of a road trip going from one country to another, which is increasingly losing reality, all sense of reality and purpose. It is increasingly as if Zelensky doesn't want to be in Kiev. Well, that's been true very often, and doesn't want to make the key and necessary decisions that are there, and perhaps wants to stay away and has compelling reasons to want to stay away. Anyway, there it is. Very strange things going on over the last couple of days. No clear explanations as to some of them. A lot of information still needed, but overall, and I have to say this, the overall impression that all of these various moves, the alleged assassination attempt in Moscow, the apparent sabotage in Poland, the strange movements of Umerov, the negotiations with Russia about which nobody seems to have much idea, and Zelensky's visits to European countries, the strange agreements he's signing off while he's visiting these countries, his strange trip to Spain, or none of these things taken together speaks of much good. Now, on the other side, on the Russian side, we are continuing to get clarity. And over the last couple of days, the Russian Foreign Ministry has published Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's interview with the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera. I should say that Corriere della Sera, which I believe is based in Milan, is the closest that Italy has to a newspaper of record, though it has also been a newspaper which has been, by Italian standards, especially strong in its support of Ukraine. Now, Corriere della Sera did not publish the entire interview. Apparently, it only published edited extracts from the interview. I have not read the part of the interview, the parts of the interview, as Corriere della Sera published them. And I'm not going to spend time worrying about that. What I will say is that in this interview, Lavrov gave the clearest account up to now of what was discussed, what was almost agreed by Putin and Trump in Alaska. And, well, I don't know this for a fact, but I wonder whether, given that there has been a degree of omerta in the West about the discussions between Putin and Trump in Alaska, given that Lavrov's information about those negotiations, which he's now given extensively in several interviews and in at least one press conference, given that all of that information has been kept back from publication in the West, it has not, so far as I'm aware, been discussed in any big media publication in the West, so that the Western public is almost entirely ignorant of this. I wonder whether the reason why Corriere della Sera did not publish the entirety of Lavrov's interview was because they are still sticking to the omerta, the policy of not disclosing what the Russians said, what Lavrov has said about the meeting between Putin and Trump in Alaska. Well, without further ado, let me now discuss what the interview says. So, Corriere della Sera's question to Lavrov was this: it has been reported that Putin's next meeting with Donald Trump in Budapest did not happen because even the US administration realized that you're not ready for talks on Ukraine. That's a pretty aggressive statement anyway. What went wrong after the Anchorage summit that inspired hope for the launch of a genuine peace process? Why does Russia remain adherent to the demands that Vladimir Putin put forward in June 2024? And on what issues could you make a compromise? So you can see that here there is an attempt to try to present the Russians as being intransigent. And what then happens is that Lavrov, in his answer, completely undercuts the question, because he says that Putin, the Trump in Anchorage, basically accepted Putin's June 2024 proposals. And I will read out what he says. The understandings reached in Anchorage were an important milestone in the search for a long-term peace in Ukraine through overcoming the consequences of the violent anti-constitutional state coup in Kiev organized by the Obama administration in February 2024. The understandings are based on the existing reality and closely bound to the conditions of just and lasting resolution of the Ukrainian crisis proposed by President Putin in June 2024. As far as we know, those conditions were heard and received, including publicly, by the Trump administration. Mainly the condition that it is unacceptable to drag Ukraine into NATO, to create strategic military threats to Russia directly on its borders. Washington openly admitted that it will not be able to ignore the territorial issue following the referendums in Russia's five historical regions, whose residents unambiguously chose self-determination and reunification with Russia. The American concept that at the US president's instruction, his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, brought to Moscow the week before the Alaska summit was also built around the issues of security and territorial reality. President Putin told President Trump in Anchorage that we agreed to use this concept as a basis while proposing a specific step that opens a way for its practical application. The US leader said he should consult with his allies. However, after meeting with his allies in Washington the next day, wasn't actually the next day, it was a week after, I don't know why Lavrov repeatedly gets that wrong, we did not receive a reaction to our positive response to the proposals that Witkoff delivered to Moscow before Alaska. No reaction was communicated during my meeting with Secretary of State Rubio in September in New York, when I reminded him that we were still expecting it. To help our American colleagues decide on their own concept, notice that Lavrov is repeatedly making the point that the Russians are expecting the Americans to come back to confirm whether or not they are prepared to work with their own, i.e. their own American proposal, to help the American colleagues decide on their own concept. We've set forth the Alaska understandings in a memo and delivered it to Washington. Several days later, at Trump's request, there's been a vast amount of discussion about who initiated the telephone conversation, the last telephone conversation between Putin and Trump. The story has gone round many times that it was Putin. Lavrov is now saying that it was Trump. Several days later, at Trump's request, he and Putin had a telephone conversation and reached a preliminary agreement to meet in Budapest after thorough preparations for this summit. Now, again, we've discussed this many times on the Duran. There's been much discussion about who initiated the telephone call that took place immediately prior to Zelensky's trip to Washington, at a time when the debate was raging about the Tomahawk missile deployments in Ukraine. The word that was circulating in the media, especially in the West, was that it was the Russians, and the story was put out that the Russians initiated the talks because they were frightened about the Tomahawk deployments. Lavrov has now said, and I'll be interested to see whether anybody contradicts him, Lavrov has now said that, on the contrary, it was the Americans, Trump, who initiated the call, who asked for the call, and it was Trump who, as Putin has already said, over the course of the call, suggested a meeting, a follow-up meeting in Budapest. And the Russians, according to Lavrov, agreed that there should be thorough preparations for this summit. There was no doubt that they would discuss there was no doubt that over the course of the summit, they would discuss the understandings in Anchorage. After a few days, I spoke with Marco Rubio over the phone. Washington described the conversation as constructive. It was indeed constructive and useful, and announced that after that telephone conversation, an in-person meeting between myself and Rubio to prepare for the top-level meeting was unnecessary. Who and how submitted covert reports to the US leader, after which he either postponed or cancelled the Budapest summit, I do not know. But I have described the general timeline strictly based on the facts for which I am responsible. So that is what happened, according to Lavrov. Lavrov's description of events has never been contradicted. So what Lavrov is saying is that Putin and Trump, at their meeting in Anchorage, agreed that there should be a final settlement of the conflict on the basis of Istanbul Plus, on the basis of what Putin and proposed to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June, 2024. And as far as I can tell, it was the entirety of the package. Trump told Putin that he accepted the entire Istanbul package. According to Lavrov, Trump told Putin, the Americans told Putin, that they understood and accepted the military realities. Washington also openly admitted that it would not be able to ignore the territorial issue, and that they accepted that after, that in light of the referendums that have taken place in the four regions and in Crimea, the people of the four regions had chosen reunification with Russia, and that the entirety of the four regions, including Zaporozhye and Kherson region, would be transferred in their entirety to Russia. The only question was how this agreement, the American acceptance of Istanbul Plus, was to be implemented. And here, apparently, Witkoff made proposals that originated with Trump, a proposal that the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass, and that the Russians temporarily stop in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. But it is clear from what Lavrov is saying that the Russians were given to understand that over the course of time, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions would be transferred in their entirety to them. And then what happened was that Trump left Anchorage. He had meetings with the Europeans. He had meetings with Zelensky. He then started to dither and refused to get back to the Russians. The Russians then sent a note to Washington asking what was happening, and this is what we agreed in Anchorage, and could we please have a reply? And then, apparently, Trump initiated the call with Putin. Trump called Putin, apparently reassured Putin that he was going to move forward with the Anchorage agreement. He was going to meet Zelensky the following day. He was going to tell Zelensky over the course of that meeting that Zelensky had to accept Istanbul Plus. The meeting went wrong. Zelensky refused. Trump then backed off. He wasn't able to get Zelensky to agree to Istanbul Plus. He instead went over once more to the side of Zelensky and Kellogg, agreed with them that the conflict needed to be frozen on the existing conflict lines. And since he could not face meeting Putin empty-handed, he called Budapest off. That is the real story. Now, I'm going to say a few things here. The first is that, in my opinion, it was always a big ask, massively over-ambitious on the part of the Russians to expect that Donald Trump would be able to deliver Istanbul Plus. Had Trump come out publicly after Anchorage and said that he agreed to Putin's 14th of June 2024 proposals, the Europeans would have publicly denounced him, so would Zelensky, but more importantly, so would pretty much the entire political class in the United States, except Trump's own staunch MAGA supporters, of whom it must be said there is now a significant minority in Congress. But Trump would never have been able to pull this one off. In some respects, it is unsurprising that after Anchorage, he backtracked. The Russians went into Anchorage having overhigh expectations of what Trump would deliver, and seem and not for the first time, by the way, to have misjudged the limited maneuver space that an American president in dealing with Russia actually has. Trump, for his part, was extremely unwise to get into these negotiations with the Russians at all. And I've discussed this in many programs. We've discussed this on the Duran many times. We've often said on the Duran that given the completely irreconcilable nature of Russia's core positions and of the demands that the Europeans, the Ukrainians, Zelensky and his government, and the neocons in Washington, who continue to have a lock grip on the political process there, it was hugely unwise for Trump to try to get into the business of negotiating a deal in Ukraine at all. Inevitably, he was going to be faced by the irreconcilable positions of the two parties. And, well, sooner or later, it was inevitable that the whole process would become horribly unstuck. In The American Conservative, you can find the transcript of an exceptional lecture that Professor Mearsheimer has given to the European Parliament, in which he basically sets that fact out. In that lecture, Mearsheimer explains that given the extent to which the American, European and Ukrainian position in Ukraine is completely irreconcilable with the Russian one, any attempt to negotiate a compromise by this point in the conflict is now certain to fail. And that all but means that the only outcome that can be achieved must be through military means, which in effect means through a Russian military victory. There is no other possible outcome to the war. Deeply bleak though that fact is. Now, that is clear today. It was clear last year, or it should have been clear last year. That was why we on the Duran, Alex Cristoforo and I, back in August 2024, well before the November 2024 election, said that Trump's best course with respect to the conflict in Ukraine was not to get trapped into a negotiating process, which we predicted would go nowhere, but to walk away, to say simply and straightforwardly, this is Biden's war, and he, Trump, on behalf of the United States, was washing his hands of it. There was no chance, there was no sense in him wasting time trying to square this impossible circle, and that in his own interests and ultimately the interests of the United States, what he needed to do was stay away. Well, I don't know whether that advice ever reached Trump, but he disregarded it. He seems to have thought that he could find a compromise. He ran for many months with Kellogg's plan. In Anchorage, He went fully the other way. He accepted wholesale Istanbul class. The Russians were certain to reject Kellogg's plan. And the Ukrainians and the Europeans and the neocons of the United States, including the neocons in Congress, were certain to reject Istanbul Plus. What is now happening is that both are going to blame Donald Trump. The Russians are furious with Trump because of the way he strung them along and because of the way in which they lost 10 months of time in negotiations. I've discussed this in previous programs. And the neocons, the Europeans, the Ukrainians don't trust Trump and have already set him up as the person they're going to blame when the war is lost. So there it is. We now have the whole story. We now know everything, apart from perhaps a few incidental details. But we have the full picture of what happened in the negotiations last year. One could argue that a great opportunity was missed. I think that in the perfect world, one certainly can say that. I don't think myself that Istanbul Plus is a bad deal for Ukraine. On the contrary, I would say that at this time, or certainly in August, it was a very good deal for Ukraine. It preserved Ukrainian statehood. It avoided further disaster. It would have allowed a Ukraine in some form to survive. But realistically, the Ukrainians were never going to accept it, nor would the Europeans, nor would the neocons. And perhaps there's little point in wasting too much time speculating on hypotheticals which might never have been realised in reality. If you want a parallel, a historical parallel, I've made many comments about how this conflict in Ukraine bears some resemblance, certain interesting resemblances to the American Civil War. Well, you could compare Anchorage with the Hampton Roads Conference, which the Union government held with representatives of the Confederate government in early 1865, when, as we now know, the Union representatives were prepared to make certain concessions on the edges, but not the key concession for Confederate independence, which is what the Confederates absolutely insisted upon, with the result that the entire negotiation collapsed, leading a few months later to the collapse of the Confederacy. It seems to me that, again, something very similar happened in Anchorage. The Russians made certain concessions in terms of possible ceasefires in Kherson and Zaporozhye, but they were not prepared and were not able, actually, to concede on their core demands, and that ultimately guaranteed the failure of this process as well. Anyway, there it is. We now have the whole story, and it's important that we do, because from this moment on, it seems to me that we're going to see further moves towards the final outcome of the war. Now, before I continue, I would say that the excellent Jennifer Kavanagh has provided another fine article in Responsible Statecraft, the Journal of the Quincy Institute, in which she again floats the possibility of trying to find some means to end the war, negotiated means to end the war. And the article, by the way, is a Trump offer that Putin cannot refuse. And she says that every threat has failed and it is too late for the United States to just walk away from the Ukraine war. I agree with both points, by the way. By now, the option that we discussed, Alex Cristoforo and I, back in August, of Trump walking away from the war, by this point, it simply doesn't exist. And there is no conceivable respect in which threats against Russia, Tomahawk missiles, further sanctions, are going to achieve any such outcome. So Jennifer Kavanagh says that Washington has something Russia wants badly. And then she discusses at length how the military situation is deteriorating for Ukraine, and all of these bizarre steps, all these bizarre things that I was talking about earlier in the program that are coming out of Ukraine are further signs of this. As I said, they are manifestations of growing distress and panic. So Jennifer Kavanagh says that in order to get a deal, President Trump's best shot would be to leverage his strongest card, the fact that Putin needs US involvement to achieve his political objectives and cares so much more about the details of a settlement than the US president does. And she then discusses that what Putin wants is some resolution that would satisfy his political and economic objectives, and that this is something that the Russians have outlined many times, and it is something that it is within the power, only within the power of the United States itself to achieve. And Putin has set out what those objectives are in many places. He set them out in his original, one of his early speeches before the war to the Russian Foreign Ministry, a speech that he made in November 2021, basically peace on Russia's western border. The great problem with all of this is that, in my opinion, the moment for this has now gone. I don't myself think that there is any prospect now of achieving a compromise with the Russians, a deal of that kind with the Russians. It might still have been possible in the first year of the war, maybe up to 2023, 2024, after the defeat of Ukraine's 2023 offensive. Maybe at that point, a diplomatic initiative to the Russians to get them to agree to this kind of proposal, that might have achieved some of the outcomes that Jennifer Kavanagh is saying. But by now, with the Russians close to breaking through in Donbass, close to capturing Zaporozhye region, close to achieving major military successes in Kharkiv region. What real prospect is it that the Russians are going to be in any concessive mood? And she accepts that Washington should make clear that after some expiration time, it would still help mediate a limited settlement between the two combatants, but big political or economic bargains would no longer be on the table, and the chance for a comprehensive revision to Europe's future security architecture would be passed. But what realistic prospect is there now that the United States, that this administration would be prepared to go that far as to negotiate a deal around Europe's entire security architecture? Back in 2021, the Russians made a serious attempt at achieving it. By now, I think that prospect has finally closed, and after what happened in Anchorage, I am sure that most people in Moscow also think that. So anyway, there it is. Chaos in Kiev, clarity in Moscow. But I have to say, it seems to me that we are heading now inexorably to a military resolution of the war, and I genuinely don't see any way out. Well, I have left myself less time today to discuss the military picture, which continues to evolve fast. The Russians continue to advance in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions. I'm coming increasingly round to the view that the Ukrainians are not going to be able to hold on to Gallipoli for very long. It seems to me that Ukrainian defences in Gallipoli are heading swiftly towards collapse. And briefly, I don't think the Ukrainians have enough men or resources to put up a stand, an effective stand in Zaporozhye region. Yesterday, Redovka gave a detailed discussion about the situation in Mirnograd. Pokrovsk, as I've said, is essentially entirely under Russian control. In fact, there's been more footage of this, which appears to confirm that fact. Redovka said that the next couple of days would seal finally and conclusively the fate of the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd. The Ukrainians were making one last desperate attempt to break through to rescue them. But in order to do that, they would have to capture Rodinska or recapture Rodinska. The Ukrainians had been obliged to abandon further attempts to try to broaden the area of their breakthrough. So they had to give up plans to try to push the Russians back completely from the entirety of the territory of the Russian breakthrough of this August. So they're now focusing on attacks on a narrow front in Roditska. But the front is actually too narrow that the Russians have heavy superiority in terms of weapons, drones and artillery and bombs in precisely that area. And that by attacking on this overly narrow front, the Ukrainians are basically launching themselves into another meat grinder to no useful purpose. And my sense, reading Radovka, is that they are confident that the last desperate Ukrainian attempts to unblock the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd is going to fail, and that they expect this to become clear over the course of the next couple of days, perhaps even the next couple of hours. So anyway, that is what Radovka said. And I ought to say that my experience of Radovka is that when it provides these very detailed reports about a battle and says that it is expecting a Russian victory, then it has very good reasons to expect that victory. In fact, you can almost take that victory as a certainty. Anyway, that's Radovka. On TASS, the Russian news agency, TASS, claims that on the strength of information from somebody who's referred to as a Russian security official, that the situation of the Ukrainian troops in Rodinska is becoming worse and worse. TASS quotes this official as saying, being aware of the catastrophic situation facing their battle group in the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd sector, Ukrainian commanders have made a series of futile attempts to counterattack our positions. In the past 3 days, the enemy made attempts to counterattack against our forces near the locality of Kotlino. Kotlino is located some distance away, not in Rodinska at all, but southwest of Pokrovsk. But then the official says they lost at least 180 personnel from the 152nd and 155th brigades as a result. Ukrainian assault troops moved across open terrain and had no fire support. So that's what the Russians are saying about Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, that the last breakout attempts are now underway. After that, it's just waiting until the Ukrainian troops in the Pokrovsk cauldron either give up or the cauldron collapses. Maybe the reason for Zelensky's road trip across Europe is because he knows that and doesn't want to be in Kiev when it happens. The Russians are also claiming that they made further inroads in Kupiansk and clearing the cauldron in Kupiansk. There's a lot of reports that fighting has now begun in southern Siversk as well, and that the Ukrainian grouping in Siversk is indeed now trapped, and that the Russians have resumed operations, their offensive to capture the town of Liman and other places in the area, in the territory in the north. And as I discussed also in my program yesterday, there's been a lot of reports, in fact there's been an enormous amount of reports about the situation in Kharkiv region, the important village that the Russians captured there, to the south of, not far from the border, a place called Dvorichna. In fact, a large belt, a significant belt of territory with a large number of small communities on the Russian-Ukrainian border in Kharkiv region has just passed under Russian control. And it's been suggested by all kinds of people who know about these things that from Dvorichna, the Russians intend to advance northwest towards a town called Veliki Burluk, and that the Russians, who are now effectively in control, or I think in control of Volchansk, the defense ministry has not confirmed this, are going to push south of Volchansk to Veliky Burluk as well. In effect, that a pincers movement from Dvorichna northwards and from Volchansk southwards is going to meet in Veliky Burluk, a town called Veliky Burluk, that will bring a large area of the border under Russian control. And it will also link up to the Russian troops who are stationed in Kupiansk. And it's been suggested that this will then open the way for the Russians to recapture Izium and Balaklaya, which they lost in as a result of the Ukrainian counteroffensive of the autumn of 2022. And also, by the way, that it would put the Russians much closer to the point that they have never really been in before, of perhaps encircling the great city of Kharkiv. That would be a very complex operation indeed. Well, in my program tomorrow, I will discuss all of these things, but this is where I'm going to finish my program for today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also our Substack site, where I'm also now contributing written articles. You can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.